Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire Radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Noah Lannard from Mother Jones will be here to discuss his piece on what it would take to fix the asylum system. John Nichols from The Nation magazine will be here to tell us why socialism is now more popular than Donald Trump. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the big news stories from this week, and reporter Luke Castell from Data for Progress will join us to discuss why the so-called far-left policies are actually mainstream. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support ROF by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free with access to all of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby from Hullabaloo. So Heather, Mueller time is over, but maybe not. Robert Mueller came out this week. He gave a rather short press conference, and it's my assessment, and I think it's shared by folks even as divergent as Rudy Giuliani, that Robert Mueller was basically saying, Congress, it's your job to impeach now, and that's all for me. Bye-bye.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, frankly, I felt that that's what he was saying from the moment I first, you know, in first paged through the Mueller report. And in fact, back on April 19th, I wrote on Salon, you know, I said that, I said Barr was obviously tasked with presenting the president's defense and providing necessary damage control, not laying out the real substance of the report. If we hadn't seen Barr's conclusions and his testimony before Congress and the subsequent letters, we would have looked at Mueller's report and seen it exactly for what it was, an impeachment referral. That seemed obvious to me from the beginning. And subsequent to writing that, of course, I've read the report all the way through. That was very early. And it's been clear from the beginning that that's what he was saying. And Barr was doing, you know, this damage control operation to try and mop up what Mueller was doing and try to keep knowing that most people wouldn't read the report. And, you know, frankly, the press didn't really report it quite that way for the most part, and they should have. That's the interpretation. It's logical. And I think that when Mueller came out this week and made his statement, he made that very clear. And, you know, there were a lot, he could have talked about a lot of things in his swan song press conference, right? I mean, the report's 400 pages. There were many things he could have hit. He was, you know, this was a short and sweet statement, and that was what the focus of it was. He had two things to say. One was, the Russians did interfere in the election, and it's very, very serious, and people need to pay attention to that. You know, and we know the president doesn't. In fact, I put up on my blog this week, you know, Trump's Helsinki press conference, just so that everybody could remember exactly how seriously Trump takes that. And that was one thing. And the other was, is, you know, he laid out his explanation very clearly that he was going under the OLC rules. He was going in an abundance of fairness to the president, didn't feel that it would be fair to even say that he had concluded he'd committed crimes, because that would mean the president didn't have a
I wanted to stop you here because Mueller laid this out in three. There were three tenets that he laid out. And this is really important because specifically Bill Barr, when he gave his press conference flanked by Rod Rosenstein and I don't know who the third guy was.
Peter Carr, I think.
Peter Carr. Bill Barr made a big point of saying that he had asked Robert Mueller on that March 5th meeting specifically, or that Mueller had told him specifically, that the OLC, this is the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, which makes opinions on law, the OLC policy that you cannot indict a sitting president, you cannot charge them with a crime. Bill Barr said that Bill Mueller made a point of saying that was not the but-for as to why I didn't charge him with a crime. And the but-for being that was not the reason why I did not charge him with a crime. Now, Bob Mueller made it very clear that he was never in a position to ever find that Donald Trump did anything criminal. He had no more capacity to do that than I did or than you did. His job was only to bring the facts out and present them. And when he said, there was three things that he said as to why they wouldn't. First he said, if we had confidence that the president did not commit a crime, we would have said so. So they do not have confidence that the president did not commit a crime. He went on to say, under longstanding department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he's in office. That's unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that's prohibited. And then he went on to say that the Constitution requires a process other than a criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president.
Right.
He's basically saying there's impeachment. And then he just said, fairness wise, I can't even say, according to, based upon these principles, that I've just that the OLC has dropped down, that I can't even say that I think he was had committed a crime, because that would be unfair. He wouldn't have a judicial mechanism in which to defend himself. So in fact, that holding by the OLC, that opinion by the OLC, on day one, it made it impossible. Even if Robert Mueller had come across a tape, a videotape of Donald Trump shooting someone with a gun.
Right.
He could not say, charge him with a crime. And because of that, those OLC holdings, and he would only basically be able to say to Congress, here's the videotape. Here are the people who are in the room. Here's the death certificate of that person. Now it's your job. And that's basically what he did.
Right. And he would say, and I, you know, in my position, I cannot exonerate the president from committing this murder, even though there's a videotape. He would have said exactly the same thing. And, you know, this, I mean, I think it's an abundance of fairness that he was saying that, you know, saying it's not fair to, you know, have this hanging over his head when he has no chance to legally defend himself in a court of law, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think that I'm not even sure that was necessary, but all of this does indicate that he, from the very beginning, saw two things. He was going to be investigating that Russia interference, which he did, and they were going to charge people with crimes that they found it, which they did. And that also, in the course of that, they were going to, you know, if there was an obstruction of justice, he also said this in his statement. He said that, you know, they considered this to be a very, very serious offense, obstruction of justice, that it was important to follow up on that. You know, you can imagine, he's a lifelong prosecutor. Of course, he found that to be offensive in every way, what Trump was doing, both publicly and privately, as he found out in the investigation. But his thinking was that, you know, we will charge people with crimes as we find them, but the president, we can't charge with a crime. So all we can do is investigate, and then we'll lay out the facts and leave it for the Congress, because we can't. He never intended to, you know, present an indictment of the president one way or the other. I mean, this is terribly important. I mean, the fact that Barr said that, you know, I mean, he basically lied. I don't know
totally
how they're
lied.
Ever going to, you know, reconcile that. I mean, you know, Mueller said he believes that Barr had good faith, et cetera, but come on, he lied. It's obvious.
Well, he said that he had good faith in terms of releasing the entire report, and that was,
it was
a fairly limited, it was limited to that, and that was a pretty glaring specificity in that respect. All right, well, let's take a break, because there's more to this story, of course. It's Mueller's disposition. It's Gerald Nadler's disposition. It's Nancy Pelosi's disposition, and where we go from here. We got to take a quick break. I'm talking to Heather Parton, Digby. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I was perched outside in the pouring rain, trying to make myself a sail. Then I'll float to you, my darling, with the evening on my tail. Although not the most honest means of travel, it gets me there nonetheless.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, we're talking about the announcement from Robert Mueller that he was that the office of the special counsel was closed. They may have some other indictments that are in the system, but they can be handled by other prosecutors there. There may not be. From subsidiary investigations, particularly Roger Stone. But he did not allude to any of that. He made some, I mean, it was fascinating because he basically said, look, I'm never going to talk again. And more or less, it also sounded like he was saying this to Congress, which, you know, let's put a pin in it and discuss for a moment, in a moment. But he said, the report speaks for itself. I have nothing else to say. However, let me reiterate a couple of points. And those points, he had very little to say, but the ones that he said specifically, it seemed to me, were directed directly at things that he thought Bill Barr misrepresented about him. He didn't say it that way, but he delivered it. And that had to do with the idea of the obstruction that took place, and also specifically dealing with that notion that that he seemed to me basically said, I was never ever in a position to in any way claim that the president committed a crime in the first instance or the second instance. That was not my mandate. I had no ability to do that. No one does except for, the Congress. And so, this was, many people are interpreting it, and I imagine that's why Rudy Giuliani was so upset, that this was basically a handoff to Congress. It's time for you to go ahead and impeach, or at least start the investigations, I guess, presumably. And then he basically said, like, you know, I'm not going to testify because it's all in the report. Well, here's my perspective on that. Reports don't speak. They need to be read. People speak. Reports are read. And it seems to me, if Congress is going to go ahead with impeachment hearings, that Robert Mueller should be called to testify. Because even if it's just to go up there and read the report, because nobody's read the report, and people are going to hear it, and they're going to see him speak it, if that's the case. What's your sense about that?
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. And, you know, just look at how, I mean, just his statement, which was a very dry statement and essentially a reiteration of the report, although, as you point out, it was very pointed in those specific areas in which he disagreed, obviously, with what Bill Barr had presented. It was powerful. It's powerful seeing him speak, and it automatically gains the attention of the public and largely because he's been so silent and has, you know, followed all the rules so carefully. I think he will testify. I mean, first of all, Robert Mueller is not going to defy a subpoena. That's not going to happen. I don't worship him. I don't see him as any particular big hero. But the fact is that he is a lifelong prosecutor. And if they subpoena him, he will go forward. Now, it's doubtful it'll get to that point. They'll probably make some kind of an agreement and he will testify. Whether or not they even go for impeachment, I think he's going to testify. He is saying outright, I don't want to do this. I'm not a political person in this game. I'm not eager to go up. I mean, you know, he's kind of comparing himself to Comey a little bit, who's a bit of a, you know, I mean, he's a bit of a glory hog, right? You know, Comey's right. Always out there, you know, ready, racing up to, you know, make his claim. And Mueller's contrasting himself with that, saying, I don't want to do that. But if they want him to do it, if they decide that it's necessary, and I think they will, he's going to testify. And exactly what you say, even if he just reads the executive summaries, you know, or just, you know, answers basic questions, gives a full statement of what he found, what he thought he was doing, what was, you know, what he saw as being important, all of that is very, very valuable. And I can't believe that the Democrats are not going to push that. It's going to become necessary. I mean, they absolutely have to. And they're going to have to push these other subpoenas as well on people like McGahn and people like, you know, even somebody like Corey Lewandowski. I mean, you know, that guy was right in the middle of the cover-up. He basically, you know, Trump tasked him with going to Jeff Sessions and telling him to fire Robert Mueller. I mean, that's an obstruction charge right there, and it's one that they could easily get that guy up. He has no executive privilege, and get him on there. So, you know, you can see the outlines of some very dramatic hearings, and it starts with Mueller. And I think that is, I believe that's going to happen, whether Mueller particularly wants to do it or not. You know, it's his duty, and I think it's his obligation to go up and provide that the voice, as you say, and to be there as the person, you know, all of his credibility, all of his years of service, everything. I mean, even today, I mean, there are a lot of people carping about Mueller and, you know, yeah, well, why didn't he do this or the other? But for the most part, I think most people feel like this guy was trying to play it straight. He wasn't being a partisan in this thing. And the conclusions that he came to, I think, are reliable about the obstruction. And even on the collusion side, you know, I mean, he made a great deal of, you know, he didn't skip over that part either. I mean, he said there was interference and that the Trump campaign welcomed it. I mean, that's something, you know, people need to hear, because I don't think they're hearing that, you know.
That may not be the technical definition of a criminal conspiracy, but it's certainly the idea that you would welcome this type of interference, whether, frankly, it's from Russia or, you know, Boeing. Should be problematic. All right, well, we've got to take a break. Let's talk more about the reluctance of the Democrats to impeach in the next hour. And there's been a slight change in that question in the press. I think it's good. But in the meantime, we'll be right back with more Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, polling shows socialism is more popular than Donald Trump. Why? I don't know. We'll find out. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I've always done the best I could to get out of my neighborhood. Growing up, I spilled my blood, but you're still my home. You stay within my phone. Setting out on the highest wall, setting them off for 50 fireworks.
Hey folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You gotta check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. A recent Gallup poll had President Trump's approval rating at 42%, with separate Gallup poll reporting that 43% of Americans believe that socialism would be a good thing for our country. Here to explain how socialism became more popular than Donald Trump, John Nichols from The Nation magazine. So, John, this is an interesting dynamic, and it really, in some respects, it gets to the heart of a question about Bernie Sanders' viability as a candidate. One of the things I think that I hear in terms of the general election that people have a fear of, that I don't necessarily subscribe to, I actually have a lot of skepticism towards, is this idea that, well, the Republicans would love to run against Bernie Sanders because they're going to, dig up this stuff about the USSR and call him a socialist. It would appear that that's not, from my perspective, just sort of like anecdotally, I don't get a sense that that would be a problem. But there's also apparently some data to support that as well.
There sure is. In fact, there's an immense amount of polling going on as regards socialism right now, which is partially related to the 2020 campaign, but also partially related to a shift in our body politics, a shift in our dynamics. And for a long time, many, many years, polls about socialism, about ideology were quite rare. We had sort of shaved off the margins of our politics and moved into a zone where it was a center right, center left. That's changed. And you have an awful lot of people looking for alternatives. And, you know, the better pollsters are trying to figure it out. What they have determined, which is fascinating, is that socialism is actually very, very popular among certain groups of people. Plurality of women say that socialism would be good for America. Remember, women are the largest group of people in our society. A clear majority in many of the measures of people of color, you're going to find a view that socialism would be good for the country. And among young people, and this is folks, kind of 35 or under, I mean, you're now getting into astronomical numbers, like 58% saying socialism would be good for the country. So this is significant stuff. It doesn't tell you that running as a socialist would be easy. It doesn't tell you that, America is, ready to race into an embrace of socialism in any sort of classic sense. But what it does tell you is that there's a lot of people who at the very least are not going to reject a socialist candidate. And the final measure of that, of course, is something we get on a much more regular basis, and that is that when the most prominent democratic socialist in America is paired against the guy who's running around telling us that socialism is this horrible thing, i.e. Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, the polling data shows Bernie Sanders doing better and better against Trump, even as Trump bashes socialism.
We can get into sort of the dynamic there, but I'm sort of curious as to your perspective of what changed. I mean, I have been doing this on the radio for 15 years. I remember at the time when I started doing this, and I remember obviously the debate before then, but I wasn't as maybe actively engaged in sort of rhetoric because it wasn't as important. But the idea at the time was like, should we try and reclaim the mantle of calling ourselves a liberal? Or has it been so tainted in the American public's mind because of relentless disparaging of it by Republicans that we should just abandon the word, forget about reclaiming it, and just call ourselves progressives? And I remember interviewing Bernie Sanders on Air America in 2004, and, the idea that he was a socialist was just like people were just, the politics weren't any different than they are today in terms of, like, you know, what he would call for, and his politics weren't dramatically different from mine to the extent that they were. I don't know that they even were, but just the idea of identifying yourself as socialist, it was just seemed to be completely like, what? And now, you know, it's 15 years later, but that's not that much time. It seems like it is a completely different world. What happened?
Very good question. Well, 15 years happened, and that's a big deal. Interestingly enough, one of the other presidential candidates this year, Pete Buttigieg, does a good job of summing it up. When he is asked about socialism, he says, you know, look, that's just not as big a deal for somebody my age. And he's saying this as a 37-year-old, that, you know, you've got whole generations that have come up in the post-Cold War era. And even those people who lived in the Cold War era, the passage of time has taken a lot of the sort of negative imagery away from socialism, right? There's not this sense of it as, you know, something coming out of Moscow. Not that it ever was, by the way. Remember, most of the world always understood democratic socialism is something radically different from Soviet communism. But the passage of time has eased a lot of those, if you will, tensions. And then there's something else that's probably just as important. If you think of the last 15 years, you have a tremendous number of indications of places where capitalism hasn't done that well. Right. We had the meltdown of the global economy in 2007, 2008, 2009. And you've had a recovery from that, but not a sense of a recovery that was equal, that was fair, that was just. I mean, you still have this situation of an enormous gap between the rich and poor, and a real understanding of the play out of that global economic meltdown as, you know, government rallying its power, rallying its strength, not to bail everybody out, but to bail the banks out. Right. And so I think a lot of discussions shifted and people started to ask all sorts of questions. Now, the final thing, so we've got a couple things in play. Number one, long time from the Cold War. Number two, a lot of concerns about how capitalism is not working at this point, in the view of many people, failing. Number three, a final element. Sanders in 2015, when he had roughly 3% support, decided to mount a presidential campaign in which he went out and used the term democratic socialism without apology and associated it with a set of ideas, Medicare for all, free college, economic, social, racial justice initiatives of all sorts of different character, shapes, and forms. And it worked. He didn't get nominated, but he got, you know, 1,800 delegates to the Democratic National Convention and really in many ways became a face of the future of what the Democratic Party might be. And I think if you put those three elements together, it's just created a very different discussion as regards democratic socialism.
I mean, it is so stunning. And I know that you know how stunning that change has been. I spend, you know, in my office, I talk to a lot of people in their 20s, in their 30s, and I don't think they can fully comprehend just no pun intended, radically different the environment is today than it was just 15 short years ago. Because I don't think when I look at like 2005 to 1990 that there was that dramatic of a change. There was a lot, and I think you're absolutely right. We have this confluence of things that are happening where the fall of the Soviet Union in 1993 is now far enough in the rearview mirror that the ballast or the fulcrum of our sort of cultural conversations are dominated by people who did not grow up in the Cold War era. And we also have a generation that's subsequent to them, or part of them in many respects, who came of age when the economy completely bottomed out. And then there was someone who came along who started to articulate these things that spoke to those people. And those three things happened, and here we are. And that we have socialism as more popular than Donald Trump. Well, listen, John, I want to take a break. We come back. I want to talk about the implications of that on the 2020 race and beyond. And also, you know, it raises an interesting question as to how socialism as a movement has changed as well. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to the great John Nichols. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. Right now I'm talking to John Nichols about his piece in The Nation magazine, Socialism is More Popular Than Donald Trump. So, John, in the last segment we were talking about the reasons why socialism, and we're talking about obviously the democratic socialism, and socialism rides across a spectrum of things. We have socialism in the form of Social Security in this country and Medicare. We just do not allow as many people as we probably should and hopefully will participate in it. And you mentioned there were three major sort of forces that have pushed socialism to the forefront, that being the demise of the Soviet Union in 1993 and a generation, multiple generations now that grew up without this specter of the Cold War, the financial crisis, probably the worst recession we've had in the lifetime of almost everybody alive at this point, right? Certainly anybody who was a working adult is pretty much had left us. And so this was the biggest crisis of really anyone's life, financial crisis. And Bernie Sanders, who had been plugging away for 30 some odd years as a democratic socialist, decides to run in 2016. And the message catches on like wildfire, just indicative of that. You know, the idea of Medicare for all has now been adopted by the vast majority of the, I don't know, 75 people running for the Democratic nomination. indicative of where the sort of the center of the party has gone. I'm curious if, and I want to talk about how this could impact the 2020 election, but just briefly, I feel like Bernie Sanders wasn't even aware of this change when he decided to run, and what he found on the campaign trail in 2016 changed him in some respects in terms of what he saw his role. Because, I think, you know, for years, this guy was a guy who was in many respects functioned as the conscience of the left. But he would say his piece and there was no mechanism for him to, you know, in any way, imagine that his policies would be put in place. But after 2016, the success he had on the campaign trail, he seems to have refashioned himself in some ways as someone who is, you know, more serious about the execution phase of these policies.
Well, let me offer what's perhaps a radical notion. If Bernie Sanders had started his 2016 campaign with an understanding of how well it would have done and of how many people were comfortable with or at the very least unconcerned with the fact that he was a democratic socialist, and many more people were actually excited by that fact. If he had started with that understanding, I believe he would have been the Democratic nominee in 2016.
I don't think that's a radical. I have contended for a long time that if he had entered the race 6 months earlier, in which he would have done had he had that understanding you're talking about, I think it's it's pretty clear that at the very least it would have been extremely, extremely close, and he would have won. I really do think that that would have been the case. But go ahead.
Well, I mean, and so we're on the same page here. The reason I say it's somewhat of a radical notion is because it forces us to go into a hypothetical zone. Obviously, Bernie Sanders got into that 2016 race, I think it's fair to say, with an idea of trying to advance an agenda, to advance a set of ideas. When I interviewed him about it early on, he expressed concern. He said, I don't want to run if it's going to harm progressive politics in America. I don't want to get out there and advance these ideas and then fail miserably, right?
Right.
And so this was the perspective he was working from. Obviously, once he did get out there, put the ideas on the table, here were these masses of people showing up, and especially a lot of young people. And they were not merely interested in embracing his candidacy. They were actually interested in doing the movement politics that he had always been excited about. And so suddenly you saw this incredible burst in the membership of Democratic Socialists of America. And suddenly you saw people who were campaigners for him in 2016 turning around and getting nominated for office in 2018,
right?
People like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so, you know, there's this something very big happened there. And like I said, if Sanders had known that that possibility existed, if anybody had really known that that possibility existed, you might have had a very different 2016. Now the question becomes, where does it go in the next stage? And that has something to do with Sanders. He's running for president again. But it also has a lot to do with a changing dynamic within the Democratic Party. And I would really emphasize to you, here we're having all this discussion about what these polls show and you know, what we have seen. There is still a real wrestling within the Democratic Party about what to do with this word and with some of these concepts we're talking about. And that is not settled. That's really, in many ways, what the 2020 race is about. And here's a dynamic that I think people ought to consider. If Bernie Sanders were to be the Democratic nominee in 2020, he is very comfortable talking about democratic socialism and talking about it in perspective. There is a challenge for some of the other candidates, because some of the other candidates are much more uncomfortable with it. And to my mind, when Donald Trump runs around talking about socialism and trying to talk socialism down and get people scared about it, I don't think he's thinking about Bernie Sanders so much. I think he's actually thinking about other candidates to whom he would try to apply the term and presuming that they would not be as comfortable talking about it.
I think that is So right on the money, John, and I think you're absolutely right about that. We've seen it happen before, right? They call Barack Obama a socialist, and Obama always had to sort of make the case, sort of thread this needle between policies that, you know, are, you know, socialistic, right? You know, Social Security, whatever it is, mm-hmm. and denying that term. And one of Bernie Sanders' strengths is this ability of, like, he doesn't have to spend time pretending that, you know, his policies are not socialistic in terms of, like, you know, helping everybody. He's quite adept at defending it. He has a perfect rationale for it. But John, that's all the time we have this week. I'm sure we can revisit this conversation over the upcoming very long 2020 primary. John Nichols, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure to be with you, Sam.
John Nichols, a pioneering political blogger, writes about politics for The Nation magazine as their national affairs correspondent. He's the author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week that's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.